Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. On today's episode, we're talking about the history of globalization and how it can shape our future. Here to discuss is our very special guest, Professor Jeffrey Sachs. Professor Sachs is a world-renowned economics professor, best-selling author, innovative educator, and global leader in sustainable development. He is widely recognized for his bold and effective strategies to address complex challenges, including debt crises, hyperinflations, the transition from central planning to market economies, the control of AIDS, the escape from extreme poverty, and the battle against human-induced climate change. Professor Sachs currently serves as the director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, and he is the president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network. He has authored and edited numerous books, including three New York Times bestsellers, The End of Poverty, Commonwealth, Economics for a Crowded Planet, and The Price of Civilization. Today, we will be discussing his most recent book, The Ages of Globalization, Geography, Technology, and Institutions. Professor Sachs was twice named among Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential World Leaders. The magazine also named him the world's best-known economist. A survey by The Economist magazine ranked Professor Sachs as among the three most influential living economists. And the New York Times called him probably the most important economist in the world. Professor Sachs, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Edward. Thank you so much.
So, Professor, thank you so much for taking the time. We're very happy to have you on the show today. As I said earlier, we will be focusing on your most recent book, The Ages of Globalization, a book that is very illuminating to what has actually taken place over the course of human history with regard to globalization. You know, people like to think globalization is a relatively recent phenomenon, but in fact, it's been around in one form or another for many millennia. But before we dive into some of the specifics of the book, why don't we have you talk a little bit about the book and why you decided to write about this topic?
It's interesting that you say that people think it's globalization's a new phenomenon. I did too when I started my career in the 1980s as a professor at Harvard and as an economic advisor. And I worked in Latin America. Many economies were opening up to international trade. And I thought, well, that's globalization taking shape. Then I learned a little bit more and came to know that in the high imperial era of the late 19th century, British Empire and the other European empires, there was a period like free trade, although under this imperial structure. And I thought, okay, that's when globalization started. Then, as I learned more in my life and more about economic history, I thought it was plausible to say that globalization started with Columbus's voyages and with the beginning of transoceanic trade. Indeed, Adam Smith said that the voyages of Columbus and Vasco da Gama were the two most significant events in human history, because they connected all parts of the world together. And I said, okay, globalization goes back to 1500 in its first variant. But then as I learned a little bit more, I realized much more than I had known and that I should have known earlier, how much trade there was between the Roman Empire and Han China. In 100 AD, for example. And then as I became more familiar, I'd say over time, with the anthropological and archaeological studies and became more interested in those, you realized, Edward, that no matter what the period, there was obviously long-distance movement of precious items, of gems, of metals, because you'd find weapons or arrowheads or stones that were so far from their native quarries that obviously they had been carried very long distances and probably were part of a process of long distance trade. The truth is, human beings for at least 50,000 years have been spread out all over the world. We used to walk or at most coastal canoeing or outriggers for most of that history. So trade was slow, laborious, not at the instantaneous scale as now, but the interchange across even large regions has been part of humanity from at least the period of the out of Africa spread of modern human beings to all parts of the world. We know that we are basically peopled globally by dispersions or outmigrations from Africa of what are anthropologists and biologists call anatomically modern humans. That's us, Homo sapiens. From sometime around 70,000 to 50,000 years ago, we're one species and we spread out around the world and engaged not only in long distance migration, but in long distance trade. So I wanted to understand the evolution of this process over this very long period. And one issue that became more and more dominant in my experience and thinking in working across different regions of the world for many decades was how geography, whether you're in the tropics with malaria, whether you're in a polar region with no growing season, whether you're in the temperate zone where I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, or where I've lived my adult life in Boston and New York, how that made a difference to the shape of civilization. I worked in landlocked countries quite a bit, in Bolivia or in Kyrgyzstan or in Bhutan, and it was always an overwhelming fact for those countries. We're landlocked. What do we do?
Right.
So that makes a big difference. So I wanted to try to put those pieces together as well. And that's why the subtitle of the book, Geography, Technology, and Institutions, is a kind of riff or meditation on the interactions of the physical world, the human know-how, technology, and the governance and markets that are the ways that we organize our lives and organize the economy.
Well, it's certainly a pretty tall task that that you undertook. You say that in each age of globalization, and you highlight seven distinct ages of globalization, that human beings have become more aware of the wider world, and that by examining the history of globalization, we can make wiser choices for our societies and economies in our own time. I know it's a lot to unpack, but can you quickly walk our listeners through the seven stages and maybe, you know, one of their major advances? And I guess talk about, you know, how understanding what happened during those periods can help policymakers and individuals make better decisions.
So I'm mostly a materialist in my outlook and philosophy, meaning that I think that probably the most fundamental drivers of long-term change are technologies, how we do things. But of course, I quickly add that the technologies deeply influence how we think about things and how we form our institutions. So that's the so-called idealism side. Is it ideas or is it the material realities that shape the world? It's both, obviously. But I do think that a basic driver of long-term change is know-how or technique, technology. The Greeks called it techne, which is the art of making something, basically. And humanity, hominids, even before anatomically modern humans, learned how to harness fire. And that was a transformation of our whole genus, the Homo genus, which eventually gave rise to Homo sapiens, the Homo with knowledge, we think. Not so wise sometimes, but in any event, that's how we have named ourselves. So fire is a defining part of the Neolithic period before the agricultural era of human settlements. People were all humans were hunter-gatherer societies. There was no settled humanity. People hunted and gathered, used fire in a variety of ways, both to shape the landscape and to cook the food. And biological anthropologists have thought a lot about how that affected our physical evolution, our brain capacity, and our social evolution as bands gathered around the campfire and defined themselves as the in-group that would then fight the other group, the out-group, for territory, shaping the us versus them kind of mindset, the fierce loyalties within a group, the readiness to slaughter someone identified in the out-group, which I think is a pretty fundamental part of human psychology. Then comes the discoveries and technologies of agriculture, starting somewhere around 10,000 years ago with the end of the Pleistocene, the beginning of the Holocene era, the warming from the last great glacial period, and a lot of discussion these years about how did that get started? Was it good for us? Was it bad for us? Well, it was fundamental transformation. We became a settled species, starting to live in small settlements, then villages, and eventually some people living in cities. And that is the period from 10,000 years ago to about 3,000 BC or 5,000 years ago, which I define as the third period with the next great breakthrough, the kind of Neolithic automobile, you could call it, which is the horse. We needed a way to get around. And it seems so obvious. Of course, the horse was the automobile of that age. But a main point, I think, for us in human history is that the horse was relatively confined geographically to grassland regions and temperate zone regions. Horses do not do well in the hard tropics. And there were no horses after around 10,000 BC in the Americas because they were hunted to extinction, which was just a terrible bad luck for the native populations living in the Americas because they had to walk after that. There were no large land mammals that could provide transport other than the modest exception of the llamas and alpacas in the high Andean region, which were very restricted geographically. So here you had the horse civilizations forming from the Atlantic Ocean tip of the Iberian Peninsula all the way across to the Pacific Ocean in China, and a large band of geography basically where horses could thrive, which is mainly the grasslands, or where they could survive and be integrated into agriculture, politics, warfare, chariots, cavalry, in the places we know and the origins of Western civilization, like Greece and Rome. And the charioteers are, of course, well known, but shouldn't be taken for granted because they didn't exist in Africa, in the tropics. They didn't exist anywhere in the New World. And this meant that already there was one part of civilization with a major breakthrough for transport and energy that was not shared elsewhere. And I think that was a huge advantage for that era of globalization. And almost every major empire that we remember today, the Roman Empire, the various Persian empires, the Parthian empire, the Han, the Mauryan Empire of India. This is along a geographic band that all were characterized as having horse-based militaries, cavalries. The conquests of Alexander the Great, of course, he was on horseback. And that was his great, every statue of Alexander, right. Every image of Alexander is on his beloved horse. And he named cities all over Asia after his horse. But that was the unique technology of the time. Then the next phase, the classic age, the imperial age, it was called the Axial Age by a German philosopher, Karl Jaspers, is suddenly this age of philosophy, and the great religions are born during this period. It's a remarkable period from about 800 BC to about 300 BC. Judaism is formed, which becomes the basis of Christianity and becomes the basis later on of Islam. Buddhism, of course, takes shape. Confucianism takes shape. So Zoroastrianism in Persia takes shape. This is the age of the great Persian-Greek battles covered by Herodotus. And then later the Peloponnesian Wars, then the conquest of Alexander the Great. And what happens here is incredible, because all of the flowering of our philosophy and our knowledge and our religious and ethical ideas are clearly rooted in this period. And I would guess that the definitive breakthrough was actually the alphabet. The alphabet made possible
interesting
writers like us, like me, to write books, because before then you had bards who sang tales like the Iliad and the Odyssey, of course. But then things started to get written down. And Socrates was rather suspicious of writing. He said, we're going to lose our memories because it's all going to be in the book. You won't have to remember anymore. But by the time Socrates' student, Plato, came, of course, his dialogues were written, thank God, because they're priceless in terms of their importance for Western civilization. My favorite philosopher is Aristotle. Plato's student. And thank goodness we have the ethics, the politics, the metaphysics, rhetoric, we don't have all of Aristotle's teachings, but we have enough to know what a genius that man was, because every book he wrote started a new field,
right.
That became the field of knowledge. Then that is the third era. And I jump to from there to the age of Columbus, the transoceanic discoveries, because there's a long period of empires fighting each other. The Roman Empire, even the rise of the Ottoman Empire and the conquest of Constantinople that became Istanbul. And of course, the rise of Islam and the various caliphates. Are part of that classic age in my accounting. And that brings us to the transoceanic empires, because all of these empires that I mentioned, and ultimately the Mongol Empire, which was the largest land empire in human history, were contiguous land-based empires, essentially, or colonies on islands, such as in the Mediterranean, the Phoenicians and the Greeks. Whereas now, with the discoveries of Columbus and Vasco da Gama, Europe starts colonizing transoceanic regions. And we begin the era of early capitalism with institutions like the East India Company, which was the English company with investments of Queen Elizabeth that started the conquest of India, actually. First trading, then military conquest, then eventual takeover of most of India by a company, very unusual. But that was the beginnings of corporate capitalism. And it's a quite dramatic period. Also, that was the period of African slavery. Mass shipment of 14 million estimated Africans in bondage across the Atlantic to the Americas in one of the most brutal episodes of human history. And the ocean navigation clearly was fundamental. The rise of cannon-based empires, so large artillery and gunpowder, all of which China could have used, but it turned out to be the West that used it in a dominating way, defined that era. It's also an era that I find fascinating because 500 years ago, so we're at the 500th anniversary, and it's a period of intellectual ferment that is absolutely unbelievable. No doubt, I think, because suddenly there's a new world opened up, so all of the old truths start collapsing. This is when Luther provokes the Protestant Reformation. It's when Copernicus overturns the geocentric vision of the universe and creates the heliocentric vision of the universe. It's when Machiavelli writes The Prince and changes completely the vision of politics to one of rather ruthless Machiavellianism. And the list goes on intellectually, but it also gives rise to the scientific revolution. It eventually gives rise to Francis Bacon with experimentalism, and then to Isaac Newton. And it puts Britain on a fast track because there is now the center of scientific knowledge and a, not a tinkerer exactly, but a technician in the 18th century or series, it's right to say, from 1696 to about 1776, create what becomes the next absolutely transformative technology, which ushers in the sixth era of globalization, and that is the steam engine. And the steam engine invented by Newcomen first, and then James Watt commercializing a steam engine in the 1770s, makes industrialization possible. And with industrialization comes power, transport, factory production, and industrial scale military force that was completely unprecedented in human history. And it gives rise to the British Empire and other empires, but the British Empire is the grand empire of the day. And, you know, you could say the rest is history, but there's been a lot of history since then. The Anglo world became the American-led world, so we remain within the English language, but the baton passed from Britain to the United States in terms of global hegemonic power after two European world wars. But in the period and in the midst of all of this, and this is what we're living through now, the Seventh Age, comes yet another fundamentally transformative technology, which completely upends everything economically once again, and that is the digital world. And it's our world, and it's a profoundly transformed world already, but one where we're only feeling the ground moving beneath our feet in every which way every day, including the ability to just routinely now Zoom together to have this discussion. And it will change, like all the other periods, it will change geopolitics. It will change the physical geography. It will force us, or how physical geography interacts with humanity, I should say. and it will force us to change institutions as well, and our way of thinking. So this is the grand drama, but probably the consistent underlying arrow in all of that is know-how, whether it's the know-how of fire, agriculture, horses, alphabet, transocean shipping, steam engine, or digital technology. I see those as the great protagonists of history, and we're carried along for the ride to a large extent.
Well, Professor, thank you for going through those stages in such detail, because it is a lot to wrap your head around, and I'm glad you took the time to do that. One thing that I guess we have to, take into consideration is that human population growth, the rate of urbanization and global output are key variables in this whole process. And, I guess of those three, one of the easier to maybe discuss is human population growth. And for the longest time, economists and really the general public believed that Thomas Malthus was correct when he suggested that, any short-term gains in living standards would be undermined as population growth outstripped food production and thereby driving living standards back towards a subsistence level. So could you talk a little bit about, the Malthusian curse and why his analysis, turned out to be too pessimistic? And maybe going forward, why we have not fully disproved his warnings.
Malthus was probably the economics profession greatest pessimist, the professional pessimist, because he basically argued, especially in the first edition of The Principles of Population, which was in 1798, don't expect any long-term improvement of well-being, because the underlying dynamics of human population would undo any gains. And you sketched the argument that suppose there's an improvement of living standards. Malthus said, well, more children will be born, more children will survive, the population will grow, the increased population will create an increased demand for food against a given amount of land area in the world. And that growing population will start driving down the living standards, offsetting the gain. And in fact, the pressures of growing populations will continue until population growth stops the hard way by more return to hunger, destitution, war, conflict, disease, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And so while Malthus was himself a preacher and a moralist, he was a pessimist and said, don't aim for improvement even. It's misguided. The indirect effects will offset any direct benefits. And that idea economists love, by the way, the idea that don't try to do good. Something hidden around the corner will offset your do-goodism. Right. And I would say that the profession still has that basic view. Aha, I'll find the hidden cost to your idea so we can't really improve things. That was Malthus who got us started on that. He was too pessimistic. He was accurate to some extent, because when he wrote, there were about 800 to 1 billion people in the world. There are uncertainties in the precise calculation, but around 1800, somewhere between 800 million and a billion people. And today there are about 8 billion people in the world. So Malthus said, if you increase living standards, the population will soar. What Malthus did not really accurately recognize was, first, that even in his day, population increase was never automatic. It was always socially determined, in that the English population, for instance, had been regulated for decades, not by rules and regulations, but by the behavior of people, that when the situations were bad, people would marry later, have fewer children. There was a kind of self-regulation to keep the economy, population at moderate growth. And England indeed had longer term increases of living standards that Malthus hadn't really noticed properly. So he wouldn't have even been so pessimistic had he looked just at his own society with quantitative data that now we have available. But what he also missed was a basic point, which was that after households reached a certain living standard, and especially after girls went to school and became literate, joined the workforce, families didn't want to have so many children. They were expensive. Right. It's hard to raise a kid. You know, where are we going to put them? We got to feed them. They got to go to school. It's we got to clothe them. So households decided they wanted fewer children, and along came also better and better contraceptives, more effective, easier to use. The combination of the economic pressures, which were already to some extent regulated within marriage and by date of marriage, age of marriage, and so on, and then contraception, meant that, lo and behold, on a voluntary basis, not forced by government, urban households with education did not want to have 6 or 8 or 10 kids. And anyway, the kids were surviving, so they didn't have to worry about surviving heirs and so on, or kids to take care of them. They knew that having 2 or 3 would be probably sensible for them, living in an urban environment, expensive rent, expensive schooling, right, and so on. The upshot of it is that every part of the world has had what we call a demographic transition to essentially a replacement rate fertility or below, meaning households having 2 kids, 2 adults having 2 kids, basically, or even fewer than 2 on average, meaning that the population doesn't just run out of control. There's only one place in the world today with a high fertility rate persisting, and that's in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's mainly, in my view, because Africa remains today still predominantly rural and still too many girls not able to get an education. But I think this is going to change pretty quickly. So my hope and view is that we're going to end up showing that Malthus was not right, because his view that there was a kind of automatic response from higher living standards to rising populations until enough pressure brought the living standards down will turn out to have been not entirely wrong, but greatly exaggerated in outcome. Now, having said all of that, it is important for us to recognize we've got 8 billion people in the world. Every one of them wants, and I would say morally deserves, a good nutrition today, safe water, sanitation, access to transport, electricity that works. Now everyone needs a mobile phone, and you literally need it to be part of a society and even to be safe anywhere in the world. We've got a big organizational challenge. 8 billion people is a lot of people. Probably the human population is going to rise to at least 9 billion, probably 9.5 billion, barring disaster, and maybe we'll cap at around 10 billion and then decline in the second half of the 21st century. We haven't completely proved Malthus wrong, because we have to show that 8 to 10 billion people can live productively, prosperously, and environmentally sustainably on the planet. And we have not proved that decisively yet.
Right. Well, you know, one of the main points of your book is that any economic system of any time rests on three foundations: geography, technology, and institutions. And that it's their interactions rather than them in isolation that is what is important. Can you walk our listeners through what exactly that means?
Well, consider today geography. How is this going to play out? It depends on a lot of things. First, we've experienced the shock that we're still incredibly vulnerable to infectious diseases. And I knew it because I have worked on AIDS, TB, and malaria a lot in the past. But I'd say most people in the United States and in developed countries had forgotten about these risks to a large extent, not entirely, because they traveled or they knew. But COVID-19's been a complete shock. But one would say geography shapes infectious diseases because the vectors like mosquitoes that carry malaria, but many other diseases as well, are determined by geography. Dengue fever and Zika virus and many other diseases that we know about. Even if we don't experience them in New York City, we experience them with friends who travel or as we travel and so forth. The future of disease endemicity is a big question. Second, climate change. What's it going to do to us? Many hazards ahead because we've not been smart enough to get this under control yet. But crops are going to fail with increasing frequency. Storms are going to absolutely do more devastating damage than we can recall. We're still reeling in New York from even 10 years, almost 10 years now of Superstorm Sandy. But these major hurricanes are going to be coming more frequently because of a warming Caribbean, a warming planet. Certain parts of the world are likely to be so consistently flooded. And if we get the bad roll of the dice, a multi-meter rise of sea level because of warming and destruction of Antarctic ice sheets, you could have hundreds of millions of people living today at low elevation near the coast that find that this is completely unmanageable. Bangladesh, which lives in the delta of the Brahmaputra and Ganges rivers, if there's a rise of a few meters sea level, this is devastating. This isn't a small inconvenience. Your home is, your basement's flooded. This is your country. It becomes unmanageable. Of course, a lot of small island economies could disappear entirely under the ocean. They're very much aware of that and pleading for some attention and help now. So we are still in for a lot of geographic pressures from water stress, droughts, floods, storms, infectious disease in an age of climate change. We're in a change of geography because of digital. So this is the opposite. It used to be if you wanted a job, you had to be near your office place or within commuting time of your office. But if your office is your device, if it's your home, if it's your Zoom, that's going to reshape geography as well. Maybe we're going to be working for businesses 5 or 10,000 miles away, because what difference does it make?
Right.
The electrons travel fast enough that if you're looking for a skilled worker, it could be somebody in Ghana or Kyrgyzstan or China or Paraguay, any place. And so this will be also an emotional, psychological, organizational, economic shift. I think that all of this means that we're in the midst of a lot of disruption. Disruption is a term that sometimes is used favorably, meaning an exciting new technology. For most of us in our daily lives, disruption doesn't sound so good. You don't like the earth moving beneath your feet. But I think that it is inevitable that the coming decades are decades of disruption. And the job is to shift and lean and distribute and protect in the right direction so that we're making good effect of these disruptions and not falling apart because of them. But I don't see any scenario in which we have quiet lives and just things are staying the same. That doesn't seem to me to be in the cards.
Yeah. I found it really interesting in how you highlighted in the book that the closer a country was to Britain in 1900, the higher their per capita output was, because Britain had really developed markets. And, you know, when I was thinking about geography, you know, I was thinking perhaps geography doesn't matter as much anymore, because, you know, information's a click away, and we can, as long as we can get goods and services shipped to us, then, you know, we can live pretty much anywhere. But it seems, based on what you just said, that geography is now more important than ever.
You know, the death of geography has been predicted because of the digital age for the last 40 or 50 years. In fact, the tendency was for big cities to get bigger, for more agglomeration economies, for more people to move into New York, Manhattan, where I happen to live. was seemingly the agglomeration economy, so-called, that you just wanted to be where the action was, because that's what created the markets for the next innovation, and face-to-face was so important, and so on. How this will shake out, this particular dimension, remains to be seen. We don't know whether we're going to have offices the same way, and probably not, I would say. I think we're going to go to a much more flexible approach. Obviously, we're going to have blended work, huge advantage. Maybe you go in one or two days a week to an office. The rest of the time is with your colleagues online. Commuting time can go down. Rush hours could become a thing of the past, because why does everyone have to go in at 7:30 a.m. and right. Come back at 6 p.m. or whatever it is? So lots of gains. But geography is many, many things. As I've been saying, it's whether you're near a coast, it's whether you're getting flooded, it's whether you have adequate water supply. Now it may be whether you have great sunshine. In an age of solar power, maybe the poorest part of the world today, which is the Sahel, the countries like Mali, Chad, Niger, which have suffered so much because they can't make a proper planting season, not enough water, it's all sunshine. They didn't have oil and gas, except to a very small extent, no coal. Now they have sunshine, which could be the best energy resource possible.
Right.
And you would expect that Apple and Amazon would be running there saying, we want our data centers here. This is great. You know, we're pledged to 100% renewables. So let's put huge server complexes in these countries. I think that things like that will happen. But what we'll find is, yes, geography matters a lot, but in new ways.
Right, for sure. Yeah. Well, let's dig into a few of the ages you talk about in the book. We don't have time to go into great detail on all of them. You gave a great synopsis at the beginning of the episode. But everybody should go out and buy the book and dig into it on their own. But I think we have just enough time to, you know, dive into three of them: the ocean age, the industrial age, and our digital age we're in now. You note that the ocean age was really the birth of global capitalism, with industrial power extending across oceans, profit-oriented public companies beginning to carry out global activities, and greed becoming normalized. And you already touched on how Adam Smith said that this, the discovery of America and the passage to the East Indies by the Cape of Good Hope were, in his opinion, the two greatest and most important events recorded in the history of mankind, because they united the most distinct parts of the world. Now, you noted that these events led to the plundering of local tribes, but they nonetheless fostered a market that would one day allow those who suffered from the spread of global trade the opportunity to grow stronger and richer through trade. So I know this is a tough question, but I'm sure you have a favorite. Do you think that the ocean age was perhaps the most important of the seven ages that you outline?
Actually, they're all pretty decisive.
Right. But,
we are the legacies and heirs of all of them. So it is actually hard. I think industrialization was utterly transformative. But the ocean age itself was obviously built the European-led world and then the American-led world. And now I think what Adam Smith thought in 1776 is probably coming to pass, that the rest of the world is starting to catch up or is catching up in no small part because of trade. That's China's story. And China's right. Catching up. And I say all good to China for that, for sure. I think it's an extremely positive development. But the mindset was for a long time that the North Atlantic, meaning Europe and the U.S., ran the world. That still is the mindset of a lot of people. It's not one that I share at all, actually. There was just a press conference of the Foreign Secretary of Britain and the Secretary of State of the United States together. And they talked a lot about Anglo-American shared values. But I thought if the rest of the world were listening to that, they'd say, yeah, we know your shared values. You guys want to run the world. Britain ran the world from 1800 to 1950, roughly. The United States has claimed to run the world in the post-World War II period. What looks to us like shared values looks to other places like domination by first Britain and then the United States. And I think that the era that we're in is much more multipolar, a much more dispersed power. And I think that that is all to the good, actually. What I like what Adam Smith thought, which was connect all parts of the world and then all parts of the world should benefit. And I hope that that's where we're heading in the 21st century.
Yeah. Well, let's move to the industrial age. You said that the overriding point of the industrial age is that it was a period of decisive transformation that was faster, deeper, and more extensive than ever before in history. And, during just two centuries, everything changed about how and where we live. And I like that you highlighted the year 1776, not for, what we Americans generally associate with that year, the Declaration of Independence, but rather the development of the steam engine. And I think perhaps some of, the economists that are listening in, would like to know, do you think that the steam engine was the first or, at least one of the more important inputs into the modern endogenous growth model?
1776 was an amazing year because it wasn't just two events, one of which was Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, and the second was the commercialization of James Watt's steam engine, two pretty big events. But I would name two others in the publishing world. One was Adam Smith published The Wealth of Nations,
right,
and gave birth to modern economics, and really did do so. The fourth was the publication of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the great volume that talked about imperial rise and fall. We should recall that as well, because this is a part of the drama of our time. You asked about the steam engine. The steam engine definitely catapulted Britain from a powerful country with a lot of colonies to the world empire, or what technically we call the global hegemon. So clearly dominant, even as Britain was competing with France or with Germany, or still a little bit with Spain and Portugal for global glory, Britain completely dominated. And that was because Britain industrialized, and that was indisputably because of the steam engine. So in this sense, the steam engine was geopolitically transformative, but I think it was transformative most fundamentally. You date everything about global output, global manufacturing, global industry, global energy use, global scale of military power. It all is the steam engine. And then the other applications of energy technologies after that, the internal combustion engine of Daimler and Benz, which came in the 1870s, the gas turbine, which came in the early 20th century, but basically the mobilization of fossil fuel defined the industrial age. That, by the way, is why so many people are having a hard time giving up on fossil fuel in what we need to do, which is a renewable energy digital age. But people remember, people like Trump don't understand, because they've always lived in an age where fossil fuel defined power, not only physics power, but political and geopolitical power. And they don't get it that we're in a new era. But it was fundamentally transformative. And I think alongside agriculture, the horse, transoceanic navigation, the steam engine absolutely is in the Hall of Fame of all-time transformative technologies.
Awesome. Well, let's talk about the digital age. You mentioned China earlier, and as a result of the economic convergence that has taken place over the last four decades, China is now the world's largest economy when measured using purchasing power parity. China still has a ways to go with regard to per capita GDP if they want to catch the U.S., but it does seem that they're right on our heels. Does China's ascendance, I guess, pose any risks for the digital age? And maybe what are some of the other risks that we will all encounter in the digital age that really concern you?
I think that the digital technologies are, like all technologies, all great technologies, incredibly empowering if we use them well, and incredibly dangerous if we use them badly. This is basically true of powerful technologies. The steam engine made for modern economies, it made for modern mass slaughter also. It ended up making also for greenhouse gas emissions that are creating dangerous climate change. Nuclear energy, I don't have to point out, has the positive side and the negative side, world imperiling side. And digital technologies are the same. Are we going to get universal education, telemedicine, e-governance, global participation, connectivity? Or are we going to get cyber warfare, autonomous weapons, and fake news, and loss of privacy as the result of these? Those are, to an important extent, choices of politics and geopolitics, not inherent in the technology, but a lot about how we use them, a lot about our mindsets, a lot about whether we perceive ourselves to be in a zero-sum struggle or actually a cooperative condition, which I very much believe we need to train ourselves to understand. We need cooperation globally. So I very much welcome the rise of China from poverty to middle income status. China's still in living standards, maybe a third to 40% of US levels in dollar transactions at market exchange rates, maybe a fifth of the US in per capita. But because it's such a big population, 1.4 billion people, more than four times the US, it's a big economy, a very successful society, a great civilization, very technologically dynamic right now. And I say, on the whole, bravo. I don't expect China to look like us. We're kids compared to China, Chinese civilization. The unified Chinese state dates to 221 BC. And we are about 230 years old in the United States. So we're roughly one-tenth of China's age. And we're wagging our finger and saying, you should do this, you should do that. And that's a mistake. That's just arrogance. So I want our policymakers to read my book and drop some of the swagger and some of the arrogance and some of the zero-sum mentality. Of course, we have rules of the road we need. We need to negotiate basically a truce of, so we don't get into cyber war, for God's sake. We need to avoid an arms race, but we basically need to stop thinking of China as an enemy or stop thinking of China's development as something untoward, as if the U.S. should own prosperity and no one else be entitled to it unless the U.S. give permission. What we want is an open, peaceful, rule-based world. That's what we need to build in the 21st century. It's possible, but it isn't easy, especially given our mentality from the Paleolithic around the campfire saying, those guys are our enemies. And that's what we have to overcome.
Right. So when we look forward and we think about these risks that you've outlined, you know, you say that in the book, you say that each age has invented new forms of governance that can give us hope. What new forms of governance do we need for the digital age? And what are some strategies or reforms that you have in mind?
I think there are two big breakthroughs that we need. One is we need to use digital for improving our own deliberative processes in the United States, our own participation in politics in the United States. We actually can take national votes daily if we wanted about key issues. We actually could take soundings of public opinion or have a national scale dialogue in ways that were unimaginable to the constitutional drafters in 1787. When it took weeks to get to Philadelphia for that convention. And so what all they could imagine was a representative government. But now we can be in the here and now, hey, I'm on my screen, listen to me. Right. So we don't have to give it to 535 representatives alone. We can come up with some good ways for us to cooperate, to deliberate, to survey public opinion. And I think that that will be exciting from a participatory aspect, because a lot of us feel that the Congress doesn't really quite represent us right now. They're on the take too much. They're paid by big corporate interests or big campaign donors. But here we are, American citizens. We want things. We need things. So that's one thing that I think the digital world can do. The other thing is we definitely need more global cooperation. And I think digital can help support that. I love the fact that when President Biden wanted to kickstart U.S. return to climate change diplomacy, he called for a global summit online, like we're doing. Right. And by the way, you know, my granddaughters do it routinely. But the world leaders don't do it so often. And it was a great success. 40 world leaders got online and move the ball forward on climate change. Why don't they talk to each other normally, routinely? We don't have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars moving these potentates around to secure locations and so on. They should Zoom like the rest of us and get to normal so that we can have more cooperative global solutions to global problems.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that just makes too much sense. You know, one thing that really, I guess, came into my mind that, you know, we need to, I guess, do during the digital age, do we need to like detach ourselves from the idea that economic growth is the solution to every problem? Because in the past, we very much relied on economic growth to address poverty, inequality, stagnant incomes, and a host of other issues. But I just, you know, don't we need to adjust our calculus a little bit? I feel like if we continue with the pro-growth at all costs mentality, you know, and the way that, you know, our global population is on track to grow, we're just going to continue destroying the planet. Do we need to start preparing now for a zero growth world, or do you think that growth can and should be the primary focus for societal progress?
Yeah, I think this is a good place for us to conclude, because it brings all the pieces together of what we've been discussing. We need to define our objectives properly. Growth is a funny objective in the sense, growth of what? Well, what we mean by growth in our economic discourse is growth of GDP per capita. If you ask people around, what does that mean? Probably not too many people would be able to give you a definition. And if they could, fewer would know how artificial that number is. So what we count as growth is a somewhat bizarre statistical concept that includes the good, the bad, and the ugly in a lot of ways. It's a very problematic measure. I would like us to say growth of well-being. So I don't want us to go to stopping growth, but I want us to think about what we want: better lives, healthier lives, good societies, good, healthy diets, good, healthy environment, trust in society, economic needs like healthcare or education being well fulfilled. That kind of growth can continue and needs to continue because people need better lives, more security, better health outcomes, better quality of education for children or for adults. And I work a lot on measurement of quality of life and the idea of happiness and how people evaluate their lives. And there's definitely improvement that we could bring about, but not if we focus just on an artificial statistical measure of what the statisticians claim to be the sum of market transactions in the economy over a given period of time. Right. It's not a useless measure. It's got various uses for public planning, for taxation, for if you want a single indicator scale of the economy. But we don't need single indicators, and we don't need to simplify our objectives so fundamentally, and we certainly should not put ourselves at the service of one lousy, it's not lousy, put ourselves at the service of one very limited statistic. And I can tell you, since I knew the inventor of gross domestic product, I was a young economist, and Simon Kuznets was an emeritus professor, Nobel laureate at Harvard University, and a wonderful gentleman. And I used to go over to his house to try to glean wisdom from him. And one of the points that he emphasized is GDP is not a measure of well-being. Right. It was never meant to be a measure of well-being. Please don't use it as a measure of well-being. And I think that this is a basic point for us. So we need to define well what we want. That doesn't mean stasis. That doesn't mean the end of questing for better lives. But let's define carefully what we want. Otherwise, like you said, we're going to destroy the planet in the pursuit of a statistic. How absurd would that be?
Right, right. Well, Professor, thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned very much from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today.
It's been great to be with you, and thank you for such great questions and such a perceptive, great reading of the book, which I really appreciate, and it was wholly evident. And I look forward to continuing discussions with you.
Well, it was phenomenal, and very well done. Thank you for coming on.
Great.
If you want to get more Jeffrey Sachs, his book, The Ages of Globalization, is available on the Demand Side's library page. And if you want to access all of Professor Sachs' research, visit jeffreysachs.org. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the demand side. Until next time.